So let's get started. I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Jackie Hurst, who's a lecturer in comparative religion at the University of Manchester. Jackie is a specialist in Shankara, and she's recently written a book called Shankara's Advaita Vedanta, A Way of Teaching. And she's particularly interested in pedagogy and looking at Shankara through the lens of pedagogy, which is a very interesting thing to do. And today she's going to speak to us on the adequacy of language, re-evaluating Shankara's understanding of the Vedas. So I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Jackie to us. We have quite a long history together. We used to end up at joint interviews with each other.
Thank you very much indeed, Gavin. The title for this evening's lecture, The Adequacy of Language, Re-evaluating Shankara's Understanding of the Veda, is intended to indicate both the specific content and the broader scope of my topic. So while my focus may be on one male Brahmin commentator of the 8th century, whose writings have arguably been overstudied since the 19th century, my subject has wider bearings on a range of issues very much alive in the philosophy of religion. This is a very reverberating room. Is my voice right? Do I need to slow down?
Yes.
Yes. In other words, you'll only get a quarter of the paper. These include, amongst others, the nature of mysticism, the nature of religious language, and how we know what we know. And these issues have been bound up with the study of Shankara in European languages since Rudolf Otto's Haskell lectures in the winter of 1923-24 at Oberlin, when he was asked to speak on Western mysticism compared with the mysticism of the East, and took Eckhart and Shankara as his exemplars. Such connections also, of course, have longer roots. Our problem for tonight revolves around two questions. If, as Shankara claims, ultimate reality is beyond language, how can language, the language of the Veda, comprise the only method of acquiring valid cognition of that reality, as he also claims? And if no language whatsoever can describe ultimate reality, what guarantee could there be that what Vedic language purports to disclose is anything other than a chimera, as Shankara's fictive opponent several times suggests? In this lecture, I'm going to re-examine Shankara's work, an Advaita Vedantin who did indeed hold that Brahman, let us say ultimate reality for now, is beyond language, and who frankly admitted that the Veda has no authority once Brahman is known. I shall, however, challenge interpretations of his work which assume that language is inadequate to its task, and so locate knowledge of the ineffable either in some kind of mystical experience or in the secondary or poetic use of language. I shall argue that in Shankara's view, the language of the Upanishadic Vedic texts is precisely adequate to its task, given the epistemological and hermeneutical strategies which the Veda provides for the Advaitin commentator to deploy. Let's first turn then to the non-dual context of Shankara's thought. As is well known, his fundamental position is Advaitin. That is, Shankara stresses the non-duality of Brahman and self. When, however, the utterance, "I am Brahman," is made, this is not an egomaniacal declaration of individual personal identity with the source of all there is. Rather, as Shankara makes clear in his explanation of the great Upanishadic saying, "You are that," both reference need to be stripped of the accretions or superimpositions with which they are normally misidentified, so that the proper nature of their identity can be understood. You, the individual, has to be stripped of notions of body, breath, mind, etc. That, Brahman, source of all, has to be stripped of all phases of temporality and change, qualities, and so forth. Then the underlying consciousness, which is self, will be seen as nothing other than the underlying consciousness, which is Brahman, you, is identical, though non-tautologically, with that. It simply is the self-reflective consciousness which is the ground of the possibility of any cognition whatever, as Ram Prasad puts it. This is the understanding which liberates. Now, technically speaking, perhaps I should stop the lecture at this point. Don't worry, not because you've just come in. The adequacy of language demonstrated. For Shankara is emphatic. Even if many readers do not like it, the Veda is the only pramana or source of valid cognition of Brahman. He is also insistent that its words are sufficient to produce liberation, and that no further effort in the form of meditation to convert rote knowledge into true understanding can be required. This is in contradistinction from his inviting contemporary Mundana Mishra, who did hold that such meditation was necessary for understanding to take place. You have therefore heard the Upanishadic words, you are that. You can have them in Sanskrit if you think they'll be more efficacious, which of course Shankara would have done for Brahmasi. You've had them explained to show how their meaning is laid bare. No meditation to convert them to full understanding is required. You should therefore be liberated. Now, without making the unwarranted assumption that this is not the case, not least because presumably some of you who might seek liberation would not wish that search to be on an advaitin basis, I can hardly leave the lecture there. Shankara, after all, hardly thinks the matter that simple or indeed trivial. He is well aware that many will hear the words, you are that, and fail to understand. Indeed, his explanation of Tattvamasi in his Brahmasutra commentary is precisely discussing whether it is appropriate to repeat this teaching or not. He concludes that while some, on account of their previous study, may indeed gain liberative understanding from hearing the phrase only once, most will need repeated teaching, gradually learning to strip away, along with the wrong denotation of the terms, those oh so persistent accretions with which we constantly misidentify ourselves. The standard one he gives is misidentifying yourself with your son, misidentifying yourself with your daughter when her school has been cancelled in the snow, the morning you're due to come to Oxford on the train, certainly makes you understand what Shankara was talking about. Yet in the end, it will be the Upanishadic words alone which bring about the final understanding, the epistemic shift, I am the real. This Shankara makes clear in another of his comments on Tattvamasi, this time in his Thousand Teachings. Here he equates the teaching of you are that with that of niti niti. Not thus, or just no. No, are the famous words repeated several times in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, source of Shankara's most frequent quotations. In that niti niti is held by Shankara to remove all specifications whatsoever, the phrase removes those accretions to you are that, and in so doing, lays bare Brahman. Taught in the right context of interwoven arguments about cognition, validity, and the use of language, the words you are that themselves function to produce the necessary epistemic shift. It's like this, says Shankara. Rama is told, you are Vishnu. And from those words, he suddenly comprehends his own identity. The tenth man fails to count himself in the party who crossed the river and fears someone's drowned. The passerby comes, you are the tenth. The penny drops. The Upanishadic words are both necessary and sufficient, Shankara would seem to claim. But is this a justified reading of Shankara? And if it is, can such a claim be justified? I'd like to consider three issues. The first is to clarify the strength of Shankara's claim that the Veda is the only pramana for knowing Brahman. The second, related, is to consider the place of experience, accepting experience for the moment as a translation for anubhava. And the third is to explore in more detail the way Shankara holds Vedic language to work. So first then, the Veda as the only pramana. This is a claim Shankara frequently makes, that the Veda is the only pramana for knowing Brahman. I suggest that there's both a strong and a weak sense in which this is the case. In the strong sense, Shankara rules out as applicable to Brahman sense perception and inductive inference on obvious grounds. Brahman is beyond mind and senses, so sense perception does not apply. Inductive inference of the kind, there is fire because there is smoke, works on the basis of universal concomitance. In theory, at least each case of smoke can be seen to be a case of fire. That requires perception. This leaves Shankara with verbal testimony of the Veda. He ignores the other three pramanas that Purvamimamsaka develops. Shankara gives various justifications of its status, which I can't elaborate on here, but they include recognition of the Vedas as a reliable source for that other imperceptible dharma, the Vedas' uncomposed nature being the set of sounds which structures the universe as it is, transcends the revisable bickerings of human teachers such as Kapila and the Buddha, the non-sublatable nature of the non-dual knowledge that it engenders, and the ability to find persons liberated while still living who do indeed transcend suffering. The status of verbal testimony as a pramana is embedded in a whole set of views and practices about social authority, the nature of the cosmos, the principles of hermeneutics, and discussions on whether justification of valid cognition is intrinsic or extrinsic to the cognition. But Shankara's position, while contentious, appears to be clear. For valid cognition of Brahman, verbal testimony, and verbal testimony alone is required. Ganeri, however, has shown how in Nyaya texts, the structure of inductive inference is linked with rhetorical practices of convincing in public debate, and that at different stages of the inference, different pramanas may be invoked. Despite Shankara's apparently strong claims to the contrary, a variation on this can be seen in Shankara's understanding of Veda as pramana. Because the world is of such a type, structured in accordance with the Veda, with reasoning including inductive inference a part of it, inductive inference in relation to Brahman is permissible, provided that it is in conformity with the Veda. And this is the case because the Veda both recommends this and exemplifies such processes. Nonetheless, this does not prevent Shankara from continuing to claim Vedic verbal testimony as the only pramana for Brahman. We can thus see that this claim has both a strong and a weak form. The strong form rules out other pramanas operating independently, in part for the reasons already given, and not least to legitimate Advaita Vedanta as a proper Mimamsa exegetical school and superior to other schools in the arena. The weak form ensures that, contrary to Halptvas, Shankara does not rule Advaita out of that philosophical arena, for the rules of engagement for philosophical debate and the rhetorical persuasiveness of inductive inference are sanctioned by the Veda itself. However, for many commentators, Advaitin and secondary, ancient and modern, that does not close the case on pramanas in Shankara, which leads us to our second consideration, Anubhava. As Fourth Turtle points out, the place of Anubhava in Advaita and in Shankara's thought in particular has been much discussed. The field divides into those such as Sarvepalli Radhakrishnan, former Spalding Professor of Eastern Religions and Ethics in this university, who held that Anubhava, as the religious experience of the sages, is prior to the scripture which records that experience. He also, of course, identified this Anubhava via a form of perennialist philosophy as that which is common to all religious traditions, even if construed most aptly in Advaita. The agendas which Grace Jansen has shown are involved in modern constructions of mysticism post-William James are very much in evidence here. By contrast, Rambachan and others have argued that such a modern emphasis on religious or mystical experience is alien to Shankara, with his stress on the Veda as the only pramana. Rambachan proposes that when Shankara in his Brahma Sutra commentary includes Anubhava apparently alongside the Veda as a pramana for Brahman, it is everyday experience to which he refers. That is, experience which under the guidance of sacred text can be construed to yield knowledge of Brahman. While I have sympathy with the latter view, to which Shankara does indeed elsewhere subscribe, it does not seem to me that this is what is suggested when he refers to Anubhava as a pramana. Not least because Anubhava is not one of the six pramanas accepted by the Mimamsa exegetes, amongst whom Shankara was so keen to position Advaita Vedanta. Forsthoeffer wishes to recognise a middle path here, to allow Anubhava a space as a pramana, while nonetheless recognising the huge place scripture plays in Shankara's thought. He therefore accepts Karl Potter's view, but, quote, in some Pickwickian sense, Anubhava may constitute a proof, but it is not a proof that will ever be used. This is perhaps less problematically put if we use B.K. Motilal's clarification of the different functions of a pramana. Anubhava for Shankara is not then used as the cause of valid cognition, not least because ordinary experience, like ungrounded inductive inferences, can be misleading. Anubhava in its ultimate sense as Brahman would not need to be used as a cause of valid cognition, since the superimpositions requiring removal are already removed in that state. The proper source of valid cognition for the removal of superimpositions is indeed the verbal testimony of the Veda. Anubhava is, however, available to be used as the justification of valid cognition, insofar as Anubhava in its ultimate sense is precisely that self-validating awareness which is Brahman, which is liberation. It is not an extrinsic form of justification, like finding someone who's liberated while still living and observing that they experience no suffering. Rather, it is intrinsic, and it is, I think, in this sense that Potter's Pickwickian formulation of the issue can be understood. Now, we saw above that Radhakrishnan regarded Anubhava, religious experience, mystical experience, those terms are used interchangeably and very loosely, as prior to scripture. Whether or not Anubhava in Shankara's context is best translated as experience is a further issue. There's no doubt that Shankara uses the term frequently to refer to empirical experiences, including pain, for example, in Thousand Teachings, Prose Chapter 2. There is also no doubt that he does speak of awareness, avagati, consciousness, jaitanya, cognition, jnana, and anubhava as being synonymous with the witness or self which is Brahman, for example, in Thousand Teachings, Metric, Chapter 18. The problem is that experience or enjoying, in standard epistemological terms, involves an experiencing subject, an object experienced, and an act of experiencing. And such dualities are clearly inappropriate when the liberating awareness beyond such is the subject of the discourse. For there no language whatsoever can apply, not even terms like Atman and Brahman, as Shankara makes clear in his commentary on Netineti in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. The reason for this is simple. Terms denote their reference by referring to one of six distinguishing marks. These are name, form, action, difference, genus, and quality. Shankara makes a similar statement in his Gita commentary. Brahman, however, is without limiting adjuncts of any kind. There can therefore be no ground for applying language such that Brahman is its denotation. So neither can it be the case that we can call the final awareness experience of Brahman, or even experience which is Brahman, because no words can apply. Shankara makes this absolutely clear in a subtle verse in Thousand Teachings, Metric Chapter 18. That which is called Anubhava, he says, is only the final thought, the one which provokes the epistemic shift to that which is beyond thought. For to that, no word can apply. This, however, is not peculiar to Anubhava. It applies to awareness, consciousness, and so on, which normally include both subject and object, at least in their connotation. So I've argued that it might be better to look to the strict etymology of the term Anubhava to understand what's going on here. Anubhu literally means to be alongside. When referring to that Anubhava which is Brahman, it returns us to the notion of that self-reflexive consciousness which is the condition of cognition, but is not itself either subject or object of experience. And this seems more conceptually of the piece with Shankara's Advaita, and avoids the elision of ultimate reality into mystical experience, which, as Janssen has shown, is clearly the case in many modern constructions of what mysticism is. Shankara is not talking of some psychological state which gives access to a decontextualized transcendent truth, either in a Jamesian sense, how could he be, or in the way in which modern adepts like Ramana Maharshi have understood their experience. Shankara's Anubhava does not play this role. Now, Forsterthal, in his study of religious or mystical experience in Shankara and Ramana, concedes the difference between the two. But while acknowledging that externalist forms of justified true belief, relying on the Veda, prerequisites for advice and study, and the importance of the teacher, are very significant for Shankara, he wants to keep open the possibility of internalist forms as well. He interprets the former as a set of doxastic practices, in William Alston's sense, practices which embed cognitive claims whose prima facie reliability is to be accepted unless there is good evidence to the contrary. But because these doxastic practices are, in Shankara's case, so clearly circumscribed in historical and cultural terms, and because Forsterthal, though he keeps backing away from this, really seems to wish to make space for universalising claims, he remains committed to a reading of Shankara which allows internalist methods of arriving at justified true belief, including seeing Anubhava in Potter's Pickwickian sense. There's a hornet's nest of problems here, but at least in terms of Shankara's use of Anubhava, one which my proposal above, if not offering a felicitous English translation, being alongside doesn't do very well, does attempt to address. I have then argued that Shankara makes the claim that the Veda is the only means of valid knowledge of Brahman in both a strong and a weak sense. I have also argued that in its ultimate sense, Anubhava is not to be interpreted as mystical experience, at least as psychological state, and suggested further that when Shankara affirms that Brahman is beyond denotation, it is Brahman, which is in a very precise sense to be understood as ineffable, not some experience of Brahman. As we now turn to examine the way in which Shankara holds the language of the Veda to function in more detail, we need to keep the nature of Brahman's claimed ineffability under close scrutiny. Bimal Muttalal, in an essay on ineffability, accepted that there are things which are ineffable in Indian philosophical terms. For example, the first moment of perceptual experience, according to the Dinyanaga Yogacharins. But Muttalal rejects the view that what he couches as IME, the so-called ineffable mystical experience, is in fact ineffable. This is partly because, in its strong form, the claim Brahman is ineffable is self-falsifying. For a predicate has already been ascribed to Brahman, meaning that it is not ineffable. A bit late in the day for one like that. Rather, Muttalal suggests that claims about ineffability should be taken as warnings about the intensity of value of such experiences. He then details three main linguistic strategies which are commonly used to actually speak of the ineffable in these cases, or what is claimed to be ineffable in these cases. And these are the use of metaphor, paradox, and negation, neti-neti, all of which Motilal seems to class as non-literal secondary linguistic uses. His essay has appeared in about four different forms that I've uncovered, and he orders those three differently in the different essays, and he seems to be making different claims. But for the purpose of this evening, I shall assume that at least in one of those essays, he claims that those are all secondary non-literal usages. This has merits, plausibility in Shankara's case, but I want to go much further and to argue that for Shankara, the Veda does not in the end operate through secondary usages, vital though these are in providing pedagogical guidance and the context within which its fundamental usage is to be understood. Rather, it is in its primary and literal sense that Shankara holds the language of the Veda to be adequate to give knowledge of that beyond denotation. This is a very strong claim indeed, probably very unwise. I shall now attempt to justify it before drawing some conclusions which relate back to the broader issues raised. And I shall focus my justification on Shankara's exegesis of Brahman is reality, consciousness, infinite, from the Taittiriya Upanishad, with cross-references to You Are That and Neti Neti as well. Now, in focusing on those three passages, I follow a train of modern scholars, including Biado, Maximilian Lipner, and A.J. Alston. And I've argued elsewhere that this focus is justified by Shankara's own usage because of the wider context in which he connects these passages. I've also argued elsewhere that such passages which paradigmatically cause the epistemic shift are to be understood as the culmination of a pedagogical strategy which the Advaitin teacher finds given in the Upanishads themselves. So I'm sorry if Gavin's introduction led you to think that I was going to talk about that tonight. I'm going to summarise it in this paragraph. This complex strategy, pedagogic strategy, is set within the framework of superimposition, the view that all differences are misattributed to Brahman or self. It includes the proper preparation of the qualified pupil, forms of questioning which engage the pupil's presuppositions and doubts, interiorization techniques which help to strip away unwanted superimpositions, and the understanding of origination myths which have a similar function. Within this context, affirmations like the Taittiriya's, the knower of Brahman attains the highest, become realizable. And it becomes so centered on the continually recurring definition, Brahman is reality, consciousness, infinite, to which I now turn. This is actually a very robust translation of part of 211. You'll actually see that the phrase which is so often in English translated as Brahman is reality or truth, consciousness or knowledge, infinite or endless, is embedded in the middle, not only of a quotation, but of a sentence which is showing that if this is how you know Brahman, then you attain the highest. And that is very, very important to Shankara's understanding of it. And it escapes most of those predecessors who I've just mentioned. Given that that overhead projector makes a horrible noise, I'm going to turn it off again until I can my phone. Shankara's argument is long and subtle, but his key moves are these. He must distinguish the functioning of this phrase from the way in which sentences like "the lotus is big, blue and fragrant" work. This is for obvious reasons, as Brahman cannot have attributes like the lotus can. Shankara's initial strategy is to call on the Indian notion of definition, lakshana, which, as Byado pointed out, works by distinguishing the definiendum from that which it is not. Thus, the lotus is big, blue and fragrant actually works by distinguishing the lotus which is the subject of that sentence from those lotuses which are small, white and smelly. While Brahman cannot be picked out from other Brahmans in that way, Shankara argues that the words function to distinguish Brahman from all else that there is. Satyam, the real, from that which is unreal and changing. Jnanam, cognition or consciousness, from that which is non-conscious. Anantam, infinite, from that which is limited by time, space and qualification. And this is part one of my claim that for Shankara, Vedic language works in its primary sense, the most fundamental Mimamsa principle of exegesis that there is. It is in their ordinary primary meanings that these terms pick Brahman out from what Brahman is not. But Shankara also pays attention to the form of the sentence. And while arguing that each of the terms applies to Brahman, he also looks at the ways So in Shankara's explanation, you can break the sentence down like this. We can talk about Satyam Brahma, Jnana Brahma, and Anantam Brahma, but these terms cross-relate and cross-purify one another. So, if what is real picks Brahman out from what is not real, there is a chance that this permanent real will be thought of as a material substance, like the clay, which is the material substance cause of the pot. And this is where the second function of what is conscious comes in, for this removes from the notion of the permanent real the notion of materiality. It is not non-conscious. It is not non-conscious. Similarly, what is conscious is, in ordinary usage, associated with change, changing objects of knowledge, the knower's knowledge of them, and so on. Here, what is real, with its inbuilt notion of what is unchanging, removes this notion of change from Brahman and what is infinite removes any limitation which might be associated with ordinary human knowing. Once again, it is in their primary usages that the terms of the sentence are shown to function. Here, though, the opponent raises the problem of the chimera. If all these terms are doing is negating, how can we tell that this sentence about Brahman is more like the one about a well-known object like a lotus, and not like one about the son of a barren woman who, having bathed in the water of a mirage and with a crown of sky flowers on his head, goes out with a bow made of a hare's horn? Shankara's first response takes this as an exegetical question from an insider. Since the sentence is meant as a definition, he says, it would have no point if it did not in fact define. It's a really unhelpful answer. The issue is then to make clear in what sense it does work. Clearly this is not going to convince an opponent who rejects the Vedic text as authoritative in the first place, which is why in the Thousand Teachings, with the Yogacharan Buddhist firmly in his sight, Shankara argues the case in terms of the model of cognition which best takes into account personal identity and memory and avoids an infinite regress. A similar, though less detailed, argument occurs in Shankara's second response here, which at first sight again just appeals to a sacred text. In the context of Taittiriya Upanishad 2, Shankara points out, Brahman is not unidentified, as the objector claims. Rather, Brahman is clearly identified as the self of bliss, mentioned in 2.7.5, and as that which enters the body as the self in 2.6.1. This shows, therefore, that Brahman is simply the nature of the cognizer. And this, as Shankara has argued elsewhere, is not open to question, at least about its existence. And that's the key point. No one gets up in the morning and thinks, I am not. You might get up in the morning and think, I wish I was not. That's not the same as getting up and thinking, I am not. However, this claim that Brahman is simply the nature of the cognizer is, as Ram Prasad points out in another context, a very radical move, which shakes to the core the way we conceptualize Brahman as ultimate reality. It's related to the objector's problem here, for he finds this a most opportune point to nail Shankara's understanding as incoherent. To be a cognizer is certainly to be subject to change, and this Shankara does not wish to accept of Brahman. In response, Shankara sketches out the model of reflection, which he develops in Thousand Teachings, and argues that terms for cognition which imply change really denote the reflections or appearances of the consciousness which is the self, not the self. Change is linked with pratyayas, the mental events, which are part of the mind-body complex in which the self is reflected. It is not inherent in the self itself. It is thus the pratyayas and so on which are actually denoted by terms for cognition. But just as we can speak of the face reflected in the mirror while not describing the actual face, so here we can speak of the self but not denote it directly. All sorts of problems with that analogy, but I don't want to unpack it at the moment. It is on these grounds, I argue, that Shankara holds that such terms as jnana do not denote the self from the root of arch, which they cannot by definition, but they indicate it, the root is laksh, via its appearances. And this is why Shankara can conclude both of the following. First, that the words in this sentence, such as jnanamanantam brahma, work in their primary usages, he states that explicitly, without giving these up, by mutually controlling one another. And in so doing, they act as a fit lakshana, a fit definition, I shall say more about it in a moment, of Brahman. And by that, they make Brahman as self known. And second, that Brahman, being that which cannot be denoted, because it is avartya, is, unlike the blue lotus, never vakyartha, the referent of a sentence. So the words work in the primary senses to give you knowledge, but Brahman is not denoted by those terms. Language in its primary usages, when sentence structure and context are carefully understood, is, through this function of pointing of definition and more in a moment, is adequate to yield knowledge of Brahman. And then I come to the further part of my case. Shankara has to reinstate language, the very language which he has just denied can denote Brahman, including Brahman, Atman, consciousness, Prajna, even immediately after his thoroughgoing explanation of Niti Neti in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad commentary, as leaving absolutely nothing apart from Brahman unnegated. And this might seem to be clear evidence that Brahman is not literally ineffable. There are words by which one can speak of Brahman. The terms chosen are those which the Upanishad itself uses, required for any teaching which must use language to articulate itself, unless you take a silent is the seer. Absolutely, literally. It's a passage which is often, a verse which is actually often quoted and attributed to Shankara. He uses it once in an extremely inconspicuous and insignificant context. It is not central to his thought at all. So, either Brahman is not ineffable, or if these terms are used without any of their ordinary meaning and are treated as pure superimpositions, how can they retain their purchase? Are we not back with the chimera? I've argued elsewhere that these terms are pedagogically construed to lead the pupil on beyond common sense understandings of, for example, Brahman as Lord to be worshipped in Vaishnava temple, or as an originator of the cosmos, till they asymptotically, but via the term's primary meanings, generate the epistemic shift which removes all language and conceptual construction. This gives the term's initial purchase, but goes on to shift these conventional meanings. I have also argued that the words are not intended to describe Brahman, but to generate the shift, and that this functioning has to be understood in the context of Purvamimamsa understandings of language use. Now, such performative aspects of language are normally thought to be in direct contrast with Vedanta's fact-assertive approach, where the key statements give information about Brahman, not injunctions to be followed. And I'm certainly not arguing that Shankara thinks these are injunctions. I argue rather that for Shankara, the key Upanishadic sentences, when their word meanings and structures are properly reflected on with an Advaitin teacher, in the context of the broader pedagogical strategies indicated above, act to remove the superimpositions of the denied reference, and thus once more, via their primary usage, cause Brahman to be known. And this is in line with Maximilian's argument that a lakshana for Shankara is not just a definition, but a method. The outcome of this set of pedagogical practices can be seen to be achievable for the adherent via freedom from suffering of the one liberated here and now, and in the self-validating nature of the non-dual self, anubhava in that sense. They not only confirm that the promise of the text is capable of, and indeed has been fulfilled, but they provide publicly demonstrable evidence that the problem common to their main opponents, Buddhist Sankhyans, name who you like, namely attachment and suffering and misidentification, is properly dealt with in Advaita. There are then public criteria for judging the claims being made, which help refute the charge that the end of the teaching is a chimera. In other words, note though that this is in no way the same as claiming their universal validity. In other words, I would agree with Forsterfel using William Alston that the set of Advaitin doxastic practices gives a sufficient basis to warrant the Advaitin pupil's trust in the teacher that these practices will yield the result promised. But I would, however, be doubtful about making more general cognitive claims on this basis, and I can't really go into that in the space of time that we have tonight. What then, to finish, of representations which assume, like Motilal, that secondary usages are necessary to speak of the claimed ineffable, or which ground Shankara's use of language in some culture-transcending mystical experience? The subtlest explanation of Shankara's secondary usage is due to this. Shankara explicitly says that the phrase Satyam Jnanam Antam Brahma is lakshana. Lakshanartham. And so far I've been translating or working with that as Lakshana, a definition plus artha in the sense of a Lakshana, in the sense of a definition, and I've argued in the sense of a method. But Lipner points out that we could equally well split the compound up as Lakshana plus artha, Lakshana meaning in the sense of a secondary linguistic usage. Now, because of Shankara's insistent espousal of the Mimamsa criterion of primary usage in key passages, Lipner rightly rejects a metaphorical or remote reading of secondary usage here. But he shows that in other passages, Shankara recognises a proximate form of secondary usage, as in the sentence, "The village is burning!" I'll wake you up. You need something according to this. In saying this, the speaker probably does not mean that the entire village is burning, just one part of it. It is not therefore literally true, not all the village is burning. On the other hand, its secondary usage, applying whole to part, is literally true, part of the village is actually burning. Similarly, Lipner argues that in Taittiriya Upanishad Parsha 2.1.1, Shankara's construction allows for the possibility that those aspects of the words reality and consciousness which really do apply to Brahman can remain, and in this he's influenced by De Smet, who is a Jesuit who is influenced by Aquinas, while those which do not apply, their conventional aspects, can be negated, as I argued above. And this gives purchase to these terms, which can then more readily be seen to describe Brahman, not a figment of the imagination. Since these terms act as lakshanas, and not in their entire primary sense, for which we'd require the root vach, this does not compromise Shankara's statement that such words indicate but do not denote Brahman. It rather gives this statement tighter technical meaning. And it also fits with the later advice in Jahadajal Lakshana explanation, but I'll leave that on one side, and Lipner doesn't adduce it. I'm, however, uneasy on such a view for the same reason you might be surprised to hear as Ramanuja. For language to apply in this case, it would still have to apply via one of the grounds of denotation, even if partial, which we have seen Shankara strenuously rejects. Ramanuja argues that this shows that Advaita is incoherent, that no pramana can give knowledge of something without differences. I've argued, differently, that such an explanation is not necessary to take care of Shankara's claims that Brahman cannot be denoted, yet can be indicated in a huge number of different ways by words functioning in their primary senses such that Brahman is made known. Brahman then for Shankara is ineffable, but in a very precise technical sense, and this does not mean that words cannot be claimed to be the only pramana. This returns us, however, to the strong and weak formulations of this claim and to the place of experience. At the heart of Shankara's explanation of both Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahman and of You Are That in the Thousand Teachings, there is an appeal for the nature of the self. And while he doesn't mention it in those places, he justifies, as we've seen, the whole Vedantin enterprise as a way of clarifying in what way our sense of I is to be understood. If this sense is the guarantor that what the Veda speaks of is not a chimera, does this mean that, after all, mystical experience exponents were right, and Shankara's Advaita is grounded primarily not in scripture, but in some kind of transcendent experience? Now, the whole definition of what might constitute a mystical experience is a very slippery one, and it's bound up with different social constructions, as Janssen has argued very plausibly. Gelman, writing in the Oxford Handbook on the Philosophy of Religion, so it must be authoritative, points out that the only way around this is to stipulate a definition and get on with it. And I don't quote him either because it's an Oxford handbook or because I particularly agree with it, but because he is purporting to summarise the state of play of contemporary debate on this at the moment. He then gives both a wide and a narrow sense of mystical experience. His wide definition is as follows: a purportedly super sense perceptual or sub sense perceptual experience granting acquaintance of realities or states of affairs that are of a kind not accessible by way of sense perception, somatosensory modalities, or standard introspection. And his narrow one qualifies this experience as unitive. Now, either of these gives us difficulties in Shankara's case, since the sense of I, which is foundational to the enterprise, but which is everywhere misinterpreted, is necessarily available through standard introspection. This is the basis on which he appeals to it. But the Buddhists think Shankara is misguided to suppose this gives access to a permanent self, when it is this sense of permanent self which precisely needs to be deconstructed, doesn't affect the issue. For Shankara is quite clear that the nature of that which gives rise to the sense of I is only to be understood through the correct interpretation and operation of the Veda as Pramana, supplemented though this can be, as I indicated earlier, by Vedically based reasoning about the nature of the self. Further, Gelman's definition suggestion that it is this particular, let us agree, unitive experience which gives access to particular kinds of realities or states of affair, in Shankara's case Brahman, is deeply problematic, since, as we have seen, the mode of access is so firmly held by Shankara to be the Veda. It does not therefore seem helpful to invoke mysticism as an explanatory category here, and we don't really get any further if we take James's four qualities of a mystical experience, which I don't want to go into now. You'll be pleased to hear that I'm about to finish. Nonetheless, the notion of the self as svataha pramana, a self validating, could still be held to leave open an internalist form of justification of the kind which Forst Herpel proposes. The Veda, teacher, and so on are the set of doxastic practices which provide the grounds for externalist forms of justified true belief, using a William Alston reliabilist model. But nonetheless, there is the possibility that anubhava as justification, not as cause of cognition, as justification, can act as an internalist form of justification in the end. Whether or not this, with an Alston-type approach to doxastic practices, will provide the universalist cognitive purchase which Forst Herpel appears to seek, is a question for a further lecture. In this one, I hope to have shown why it might be reasonable, from Shankara's point of view, to claim for the inquiry into Brahman the adequacy of language. Yes, I carefully avoided doing that, really.
Because I was wondering why you were referring to the word "but" by dealing with denotation and definition. As far as I see, there is no "et" in
the Sorry, there's no...
No "et" in the sentence, which would make very much clear the definition of the denotative character. So I rather would assume that if you have the latter in a sentence and the whole sentence is the nominal sentence, one would rather expect to be asking as the verb in question, and going along this line, the whole thing is actually separate. That it's, of course, to be understood as a kind of pointing out or definition or negation to Brahman.
Yeah, the whole problem is that in his discussion of it, Shankara specifically raises the problem of whether or not it can be Vakyartham or not. And yes, I see what you mean. I see what you mean. Sorry, I haven't quite taken the point of your question. Yeah, I mean, he does deal with this in the 1,000 teachings in much more detail. He only just shadows it in the Taittiriya Upanishad, and he talks then about the problem of the verbal root linked with the sense of these terms. And his argument there is linked with his notion of jnanam as reflected, and of the verbal root and the verbal ending being the combination of the knower and the the knowing thing that we misidentify when we use verbal language all the time. So he is using the same model where he gives that explanation in the Upadesha Sahasri as he seems to be using in the Taittiriya Upanishad here. And because... does that start to come back to you or not?
No, I was just... Yes, in a way, I was just wondering about this translation, because if you translate the sentence, you would never come up with a badge in English.
How would you translate it in English?
No, I would translate it as asking what is now in a nominal sentence, what you can draw in a nominal sentence is the asking.
Yes.
So if you have the asking inserted, then it's a definition of like the original
Well, I think this is what Shankara is getting at when he says to the opponent who says, you know, this stuff about the hare's horn and the sky flowers, when he says, but it's a definition, I think that's exactly his point. This is how this type of sentence is functioning, and therefore you need to read it in this way. And if it is a definition, then he goes on to work if it is a definition of a really existing object or whatever. So does that... Yeah?
Yeah, because I think the whole discourse on the secondary meaning
But why does it come in? It comes in because from Sureshwara, and certainly through Sarvajñātmana and so on, they're all doing it. So, and they're developing that sense of jahadha jahal lakshana. So they're reading it in that way without, blanching. Yeah. And that's partly why Lipner's proposal to me seems plausible in view of later advice, but not to ring true at all in terms of what Shankara is actually doing there. I think that the notion of viveka is absolutely fundamentally bound up for Shankara with how he interprets precisely the text that I've been talking about.
Can you see it existing without?
What, without the text? I suppose my reading of it would say no, I would tend to see that as informed by the text for him. It's arguable that it could be taken in a different sense, but from his so strong statements throughout his work, I would read it as being a viveka that is based on the discrimination of the word meanings and the sentence that contribute to the sentence meaning. But, you know, I'd be open to hearing it argued a different way.
See, because the Ajasa Bhashya is not supported by any
textual references.
No.
That's very true, but why isn't it supported by any textual references?
Why is it placed in the introduction?
Why is it placed in the introduction without those kind of textual references? And I think that's a very important question. You can't just assume that the lack of textual references there means that the argument in it is not supported by textual references. And that's entirely bound up with what I was trying to argue about the role of inductive inference as being permissible provided it's basically based. And he does it, he's so brilliant. Whenever he's talking to Buddhists, there's never the trace of a Vedic quotation. You don't need Vedic quotations to talk to Buddhists. You can do it in other ways. But, nonetheless, where does his understanding of that come from? A world structured by Vedic, blah, 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 blah. So I wouldn't find that as counting against my argument. But I think it's a good point.
And perhaps another one concerning Anubhava.
Yes.
Would be interpreted in your book, this is what you're claiming, that it can only be taken as the context for
yes. I mean, he uses Anubhava perfectly happily for empirical experiences, yeah.
Now, as far as liberation is concerned, yeah. But it seems to me that there perhaps a whole range of grades within the scheme of liberation itself. Because, for example, if I'm thinking about certain Mahavakyas or Mahavakya-like statements,
which is better.
which indicates that it's not always this pure Brahman talking about that's indicated, but rather the witness, for example,
yeah.
Ishvara, with specific qualities of omniscience, of impotence, etc. So, when is that also the same realization as the pure non-dual Brahman? It seems not. However, this is the Anubhava that is to be gained. And I think this is quite frequent also in the literature. So, don't you see the possibility perhaps of again gaining an insight into Shankara Vedanta without really the penny dropping, as you put it?
Without the penny dropping.
Without it.
Yes, I do. No, no, I entirely.
The insight is that of the Lord, yet you are not.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more. I have absolutely no problem with that. I mean, what I need to do would be to check out exactly in what context he uses Anubhava in relation to those other things, which I would want to do. But no, I mean, fundamentally, I think that's precisely what he's arguing, that those sentences do give us the way towards that penny dropping. And they're not, as many readings of Shankara would imply, kind of just a nuisance because they're superimpositions, let's get rid of them, the Lord doesn't matter, etc., etc. I think they're fundamental to the shaping of how you actually get to that final penny dropping. And I think there's all sorts of clues that is the case. Whether or not I would want to then say that was Anubhava in the sense of the liberating experience, I think I would want to say no. And then you might want to provide lots of references to show that I'm wrong on that one.
Yes, and going back to what you mentioned, I think it's about the use of tattvamasi and the possibility of understanding it through Jagatlakshana. And I think, again, that Shankara never mentioned anything like that.
He doesn't, no.
So this again goes back to your argument of using primary sense.
Yeah.
In
absolutely.
These are all kind of like post-Shankara developments,
yep.
Which can be prevalent, but you can anchor that in the Shankara teaching.
Yes, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's very... I think also A.J. Austin would take that line. Yeah.
We need to stop in about 5 minutes, I think. I have a question about language, about this Viveka. Is it, so presumably from what you were saying, say this is a pot, and you can say this is a pot because it's not a bat. And so he has a sort of differential understanding of language, so you can differentiate objects in the world, as it were, through language serves to differentiate the meaning of a word, it depends upon what it is not. Now, does he make a distinction between the word and any extra linguistic entity, or is part of his understanding that the world, the language and the world are kind of completely intertwined with each other? Is it sort of a strong kind of idealism?
Well, no, Shankara has a polymorphic view of the relation between the word and the archetype. Which is very difficult. I don't know if you want to translate that a generic configuration or something like that. And so when he says that words eternally denote their reference, it's what they eternally denote, it's the archety, and not particulars in the world, but they denote what via the archety itself. So to that extent, he has a realist and understanding of the way in which things in the world and names for things in the world actually work, which is very inferior. I mean, he's ever so slippery on this. A colleague of mine who is a Zoroastrian specialist describes Shankara as entering the world of Shankara is like entering into the world with slithery snakes and you never come out. But of course, in terms of, I mean, and he's slithery even with his negative use of language, because he rejects the Yogacharan formulation of apoha as an explanation of words, differentiating by saying what they're not, as incoherent. But within the context of the conventional world, he wants a realist ontology and a realist sense of way, of the way language works, but of course he then wants to revise that completely when looked at from a pragmatic point of view.
So on the third of slippery snakes, I think we should wind up. Thanks very much, Jackie, for a very interesting stimulating talk for coming in the snow.
Thank you.